Josh.
Hi, Megan.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Well, aside from the inevitable technical glitches that are the basically the price for going on Blogging Heads, pretty well.
Okay, excellent.
We're going to start by introducing ourselves. I'm Megan McArdle, and I write and blog for The Atlantic Monthly on mostly on economics issues.
And my name is Raj Patel, and I'm at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies, and I am the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System.
So I know that you are an economist taking refuge from the world of mathematics at the Center for African Studies. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I've been trained in a number of things. I started with maths, then moved to economics, and then sociology and political science as well. So I'm sort of a very ill-disciplined social scientist.
You're a man of many talents.
that's right.
So if you could just start by talking about why did you write this book?
Well, I'm interested in how social movements in particular are fighting for a better world through creating a kind of alternative to globalization. And the place that I saw this most acutely was in the protests against the World Trade Organization in Seattle in 1999. There were 50,000 of us on the streets in Seattle. And of the groups there, one of the most inspirational for me was an international peasant movement group called Via Campesina. And by some estimates, they have over 150 million members. And they were making sounds about the World Trade Organization and also the sort of structure of international food trade that today, in the middle of the food crisis, seem very prescient indeed. So I was looking at them and looking at how their sort of struggles in the past and their visions for the future intersected with the dominant way that food comes to us today.
So can you talk a little bit about what are their complaints about the global trade in food right now?
Well, I mean, those complaints stretch back for centuries, because the global trade in food that we have at the moment is an extension of a system that was started under colonialism, where, I mean, for example, Britain colonized India and traded opium with China in order to be able to create markets in tea. And when, of course, China decided that it didn't want any opium, thanks very much, the British sent gunships in the opium wars to make trade possible. Well, today we don't use gunships so much as the heavy guns of economic policy. And what farmers are up against is a very unlevel playing field. The European Union and the United States are, under World Trade Organization rules, allowed to trade with developing countries in a very unfair way. The EU and the US can subsidize their farmers to the tune of billions of dollars a year, while farmers in developing countries are given no such support and are told, sort of cast into the winds of the free market. And when the odds are so heavily tilted against them, it's not surprising that farmers, particularly in developing countries, have some very legitimate complaints against the structure of international trade in food today.
So is it specifically a complaint about subsidies and tariffs, or is it a broader complaint about global trade?
Well, it's a broader complaint about how those subsidies and tariffs got there in the first place, because the process through which this international economic architecture has been crafted has been very far from democratic. The voices of landless people, of farmers, of people in developing countries have really counted for very little in the framing of, say, the World Trade Organization or World Bank lending rules. And in fact, World Bank lending rules are authored almost entirely by a few technocrats schooled in certain kinds of economics and certain kinds of politics here in the United States. So their complaint is not only that there are these very unjust systems of subsidy and punishment for those who are not able to have subsidies, but also that the mechanism through which those things came about demonstrate how profoundly undemocratic and inegalitarian the international sort of political architecture is.
Although that started to change, right, with the emergence of the group of I don't even know what number it is now. It started off as like the group of 20, and now I think it's like the group of 87. But the band of developing countries that came together at Doha, mm-hmm. To basically sort of almost form a union, a counterweight against the EU and the United States. I mean, on the one hand, mm-hmm. I at the time, I thought it was sort of a positive development because they were agitating against a lot of things that I'm against, such as our atrocious farm policy. But at the same time, they actually ended up shutting down the Doha talks, which for me wasn't a win. You may have a different opinion about that.
I do, because I mean, in a sense, the win in Doha would have been to level the playing field for developing countries to be able to have their own democratic conversation about food and food subsidies. But instead, that was never on the table. That was never something that was going to be discussed. And in fact, rolling back some of the injustices of the World Trade Organization was never on the table either. And I think that rather needed to be. I mean, the G77 were able to, to play a small role in, a conflict mainly among titans. The G77 was a sort of bit player in the real clash between the European Union, the United States, and increasingly India and Brazil. But the bigger issue is still around how and why developing countries are not allowed to support their farmers, whereas developing countries are, and I think that's never been really discussed.
Well, let's actually go on to the subject of the book, because I mean, I think there's a lot of material there for us to cover.
Indeed.
If you could just sum up what's the basic thesis?
Well, I mean, we're starting from the title of the book stems from a contradiction. That we are living in a world where there are, according to the latest figures, 850 million people who are starving and a billion people who are overweight. And the question is, why? The argument that I make in the book is that this has everything to do with the structure of market power. What you have is three or four companies controlling more than 50% of any major agricultural market. The market in tea is 90% controlled by Unilever, for example, which rather makes a mockery of the talk of free trade or even any kind of reasonable economics, because what it is a kind of controlled oligopoly in food. Try to show is responsible not only for driving prices down for the world's poorest people, who are usually farmers, but also encouraging the sale and promotion and marketing of food that is obesogenic, that is rich in salts and fats and sugars, that's heavily processed, and is profitable for food companies, but not necessarily the best for us.
Well, I think we have to split those two things off, because they're I understand why they're tied together, but I think each of them is sort of a rich topic in and of itself. So if we could start with sort of developing farmers in developing nations, because I think this is something that most people don't understand that well is the structure, because my understanding is that most of the bottom, what Paul Collier calls the bottom billion, the people who are living on less than a dollar a day in these countries that are sort of stuck in a few poverty traps like conflict and being landlocked with bad neighbors or having bad governance, that a lot of the agriculture there is in fact subsistence agriculture that almost doesn't interact with trade because the plots of land are too small to really grow very much in the way of food crops. Am I incorrect about that?
That certainly is a strong feature of the most acute poverty, and it's true that the majority of people who are living on a dollar a day do live in rural areas. I mean, and not all of them are in situations of conflict or necessarily landlocked. I mean, there's a great deal of poverty even in India, for example. India is the home to the world's largest number of people going hungry. There are 200 million people in India today going hungry. India is neither landlocked nor particularly sort of in undergoing civil war. But it's true. It's true that there's been a systematic failure to invest in agriculture to be able to bring people out of subsistence agriculture into something a little bit more developed, for sure. I think you're exactly right there.
I mean, do you think that is because the donors haven't tried? I mean, because this has been, certainly in the last 15 years, agriculture has been a big push for a lot of the development agencies. And do you think that it's that they're not trying hard enough or that they're not doing it the right way?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Certainly the rhetoric over the past 15, 20 years has been, we must support agriculture and we must wage the war on poverty. But last October, the World Bank's independent evaluation group basically came out with saying, look, your agriculture policy over the past 20 years is not to have one. that spending has fallen precipitously, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, around agriculture. And so, in fact, there's been a sort of policy of studied neglect in terms of investment in agriculture. On the other hand, trade in agriculture has absolutely been pushed very hard indeed. And so you have the sort of twin trends of, on the one hand, encouraging liberalization, but on the other hand, denying the means by which people in developing countries might take advantage of that.
I mean, I think that one of the things that I certainly observe is that it's quite bifurcated. Mm. That you've got people in Latin America who are doing much better because of trade. You know, you've got Brazil and Argentina that are really doing, you know, with soya and so forth, they're doing quite well out of the trade and agricultural products. But then you have people in Africa who, for a lot of reasons, partly I think it is these conflict traps that make it, and the land is often played out, and you know, you've just had all of these difficulties in conserving the land and taking care of it, and so often, you know, they're in a bad situation where they need quite a lot of fertilizer, which is very expensive to make the land yield comparable to what Latin America can do. Mm. And so you've got, on the one hand, you know, Argentina and Brazil and places like that getting richer off trade, but then you've got people in Africa who find it harder and harder to compete, and they're actually getting poorer, especially because of our subsidies.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to see why that is. I mean, on the one hand, of course, Africa is the continent that is most open to trade on Earth. And then, of course, you do have in Brazil and Argentina, but particularly in Brazil, the world's largest exporter of soy by some measures. You know, they do seem to be an agricultural powerhouse. But if you look a little closer at it, and I have an entire chapter in Stuffed and Starved about the Brazilian miracle, it starts to look a little odder, because in Brazil it's actually just a handful of super large landowners who control the soy trade, and that soy trade was protected by huge tariff walls, and the soy industry was given loans at negative interest rates by the government in order to be able to build it up. So, you know, over the past 20-30 years, the soy industry in Brazil has been a cultivated and protected industry until now it is ready to be unleashed on the world with zero tariffs. But you know, in order to be able to create a robust agricultural system, two things needed to happen in Brazil. Firstly, some people needed to be dispossessed of land. But secondly, the government needed to throw a great deal of money at it to make it an industrial powerhouse. And I think, you know, one of the tragedies of Africa is that they're getting crumbs from the table, and instead of being able to invest in sustainable agriculture and be able to invest in agriculture at all, countries are being bled dry by their loan obligations to the World Bank, for example, which they've repaid many times over.
I guess my question would be, because it sounds like what you would like is for Africa to try to, in some way, repeat what Brazil did in terms of having more subsidies for agriculture and having more sort of government protections for agricultural trade. And I actually want to make it clear, I was supposed to get the book, and it just never arrived.
Oh, right.
So I meant to read the book, which Raj knows, but the audience may not. That unfortunately, I'm doing this sort of without a net, but a blind reading, as it were. But am I about right about that? Or
well, I mean, I certainly think that African agriculture needs investment, but I don't think that the solution is to create, you know, the sorts of free markets in land let's look at a place in Africa that has experimented with a sort of free market approach for agriculture. Now, that country is South Africa, and there's been a very concerted push to have what's called willing buyer, willing seller approaches to land reform, for example. But that means that since the end of apartheid, that egregious period of human history where whites and blacks were separated by force and by force of arms, since the end of apartheid, only less than 5% of South African land has been transferred from whites to blacks. And that's, you know, that's kind of how the willing buyer, willing seller model works, where the people who have concentrated power historically have been able to continue to be able to wield it, and those who have been oppressed or have just been born unlucky are unable to be able to claim a just settlement. So I think what does need to happen in Africa is something that the African farmers themselves would quite like to see. They've been calling out for land reform. And land reform, I think, is one of the processes that needs to happen in sub-Saharan Africa. Again, in tandem with investment in technology and you know, certain kinds of government supports. I mean, grain stores, for example, now look like a very good idea when we're in a world where increasingly grain is scarce on the ground and where countries are scrambling, particularly countries in Africa, are scrambling to buy food on the international market with foreign exchange that they don't have. So I think a broad package of reforms for Africa is required. There isn't a single magic bullet, but one could, you know, and those reforms do need to be a little more egalitarian than they are in Brazil, I think.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a couple of things there. I mean, I think leaving land reform aside for a minute, because I think it's really important. My concern about things like subsidies would be that may be, you know, it certainly is in both the EU and the United States that subsidies are always sold as protecting the small farmer, and I come from a family of small farmers, so I have a certain, you know, emotional resonance with this idea. Mm-hmm. But that ultimately what it ends up doing is, because you're always going to end up supporting the entities that are the best at collecting the subsidies, and the people who are best at collecting the subsidies are the powerful people and the people with government connections and so forth. And that what you almost inevitably do is create these large politically connected agribusinesses. Mm. And land reform, I think, is something that, you know, I think it's if it's done well, it's clearly necessary, I think, in Africa because colonialism disrupted so much of the sort of previously evolved systems of land use, and also that the previously evolved systems of land use may not have been, you know, sort of conducive to doing modern agriculture.
Right.
But I think it's a tough question because you look at something like South Africa and it seems so terribly unjust. Mm. But then you look at a place like Zimbabwe and you look at the disastrous land reform consequences that land reform can have.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when it was done well, my understanding is that Japan had a very good land reform and that worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you get that? How do you make sure in places like Africa that have all of these governance problems, mm-hmm. how do you make sure that the land reform goes well?
You've asked a series of brilliant questions. I mean, I think firstly, I agree with you entirely that the way that agricultural subsidies work in the US and the European Union are sold with this idea that they're going to the little house on the prairie, but actually they're going to the troughs of the largest and greediest agribusinesses. And there is something about, particularly about the Leviathan scale of subsidies in the United States for agriculture that are very conducive to that. So I think we're agreed that when we're talking about support for sustainable and small-scale family farms, we need to be talking about something that looks very different indeed from the situation we have at the moment. But then, I mean, I think you're asking the right question about how to do land reform properly. And you know, the country that has the greatest experience of this is the United States, because the Japanese and the South Korean land reforms, and the Taiwanese to some extent, that happened after the Second World War are among the most successful in history. And they happened because the United States was scared of communism. They saw what happened in China, and they didn't want a repeat of Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan falling to communism. So the U.S. government itself went in and redistributed the land in according to some fairly egalitarian rules. Now, of course, what's happened in Zimbabwe has given land reform a tremendously bad name, because what Mugabe has done is, under the banner of land reform, gone in and instituted a kleptocracy. And so he's just taken land from whites and given it to his cronies, but without any kind of support for, you know, for the farm workers, without any kind of commitment to be able to train people to actually use the land, without any notion of desert or justice or equality. So basically, it's a kind of institutionalized theft. And yet, of course, throughout the rest of the continent, until recently at least, Mugabe was looked on as a folk hero. He wasn't Stalin; he was Robin Hood.
Well, and actually, well regarded. Mm. You know, his until the late 90s, well regarded by sort of European countries as having been, you know, the kind of moderate African leader who managed to transition in a really, I mean, the white regime in Rhodesia was mm-hmm. just foul.
Yeah.
And the quotes that you hear from the former head of state
yeah.
about how, you know, blacks would never in a thousand years vote. you know, that he managed that actually incredibly well, and that that former president is still living there, although he's just, I think, been kicked off his farm.
I heard that Ian Smith actually had died recently.
Has he died? Now I'm embarrassed.
No,
but, but, you know, that he managed, that a leader that bad mm-hmm. managed to die in Rhodesia.
Yeah.
Is sort of was a testament to the way that he had managed a post-colonial regime, mm-hmm. a transition that was smooth and where Rhodesia was still a great net exporter of agricultural goods. Mm-hmm. And then just in 8 years, it's all gone to hell.
Well, it's interesting. And I think, there were certainly odd moments in the 1980s, in the supposed heyday of the Mugabe regime. I mean, for example, women couldn't vote initially in the Free Zimbabwe. And they had to fight very hard for the franchise that only came, I think, in 1982, even though Zimbabwe was freed in 1980. The beginning of the end actually started in the 1990s when, Mugabe took on a World Bank loan. And it meant that he had to follow sort of the World Bank doctrine, and that meant that all of a sudden the sort of nascent Zimbabwean industries that were, you know, that really had only been going 10 years in a way to support a growing black urban working class, all of those were kind of swept away by these, you know, the strictures of liberalization, and so there was a process of deindustrialization, and the country started sort of spiraling down in terms of poverty. And so, you know, from once being a sort of mighty agricultural exporter, I mean, it has to be said, Zimbabwe was the second or third largest tobacco exporter in the world at one point. But from that position, they're now, you know, I mean, they are deservedly called a basket case.
I have to say, I'm probably more sympathetic to World Bank style liberalization than you are. Mm-hmm. But I mean, one of the things that I think that this does bring up is that for people like me who sort of, you know, believe in an ultimately like a pretty liberal democracy, fairly free market approach, that the way that it's approached actually can, if you do shock therapy, which was sort of in the early 90s, that's what everyone wanted to do, that you can actually then end up undermining the institutions you wanted to build, because if it happens too fast, you can't sort of have the political support for that.
I mean, I agree. I mean, I think... having worked at the World Bank, I've seen a little bit about how those doctrines are crafted within the organization. And it is, there's always a sort of battle of different kinds of technocracy. Recently the World Bank came out with its sort of World Development Report on agriculture. And you could see that there were two kinds of schools there. One that was still very much wedded to the shock doctrine approach, the idea that you would go in and just, you know, use any kind of crisis as an excuse to absolutely reestablish some basic pillars of the social contract in any country. And at the same time, that there were others within the World Bank that were looking for a sort of slightly more moderate and more reasoned and ultimately more democratic approach. But those voices tended to be drowned out. And so I think this is the bit that's often missed in talking about how these World Bank liberalization loans happen. Because governments are basically over a barrel when they accept these bank loans. I mean, many developing countries in the 1970s borrowed because of the petrodollars that were available in the mid-70s. And, you know, interest rates were 1%. All of a sudden, towards the end of the 70s, we had stagflation, interest rates through the roof, and the only place that they could get a loan was the World Bank. So through the sort of cycle of loans, the World Bank suddenly became the single lender to many indebted developing countries, and was able to craft domestic policy in a way that was utterly unaccountable. The only reason that the World Bank was able to do this was because of the lending spree in the 1970s. But because there was no accountability, all kinds of things were sort of experimented on in a way that was profoundly undemocratic and unaccountable. And I think to get back to the sort of peasant movement question where we started, that's a profound problem.
Well, how do you? I mean, I've been known to advocate for the elimination of the World Bank because I'm starting to feel like it's just so encrusted with the legacy of the 90 different previous development fads that haven't worked, that and its bureaucracy has gotten so big and so unwieldy that it's just sort of shooting itself in the foot half the time. But I think the question is, what do you do you know, one of the things that I think is objectionable is that they always disperse the money through the governments,
mm-hmm.
and often the governments aren't democratic or accountable.
Right.
And you know, Paul Collier cites in his book, which I just finished, The Bottom Billion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've read it. Well, he says, you know, in Chad they did a survey.
Oh dear, you're breaking up there. Hang on. I'm not sure why.
Skype.
Skype. Blame Skype. Are we synchronized again?
Yes,
okay,
we're synchronized.
Okay, good.
So Paul Collier talks about one survey of sort of health money in Chad, mm-hmm. from the World Bank, and they went to the actual clinics and tried to figure out how much of the money had gotten there, and it turned out that 1% of the money that was dispersed had actually reached the clinics.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because you have a government that's not working very well, and at every point down the line, that money is getting siphoned off into someone's bank account. And, you know, the government isn't particularly accountable. And yet I know on other projects that in Indonesia, they've dealt with this problem simply by telling the villagers how much they were supposed to get.
Mm-hmm.
And so the villagers made sure it came once they knew it was supposed to be there.
Right.
So I guess the question is, what do you do? You know, I think that sometimes the World Bank can undercut democracy, but other times it can be a force for democracy when you have sort of profoundly undemocratic governments. I mean, do you disagree with that?
Well, I very much like that example, because it shows that if you're serious about democracy, then actually the people on the ground are the people who are going to make it happen. Democracy is not the sort of thing that you can parachute in. No matter how much you think that that's a desirable idea, democracy is obviously something that needs to be fought for and built from the ground up. And what the Indonesia example shows is that with the right information and the right tools and the right possibilities and the right kind of organizing, people can hold their governments to account. So I think that there is a role for development aid in supporting and promoting certain kinds of democracy, for sure. But I think one of the reasons that there is such graft and such inefficiencies is that the size of the bank loans is colossal. And when you have a situation of moral hazard with the World Bank loans, at the end of the day, the people at the bank have an incentive to clear as much as much money off their desks as possible, and that means that they're induced to bundle just about everything in sort of an omnibus kind of loan, where if governments violate one or two conditions, there's no sanction. So I think one of the ideas, if one's serious about exercising the kind of conditionality that is contingent on democracy and on transparency and what have you, then the size of the loans needs to be shrunk quite radically. And to some extent, debt forgiveness is definitely a way of promoting democracy. Because, again, you know, if governments are sort of borrowing hand over fist and the economy is in a sort of downward spiral because of the onerous requirements to pay debt, that's not conducive to democracy. And in fact, the whole idea of the shock doctrine is not conducive to democracy. So, you know, one's blaming, in a sense, governments for doing exactly what the World Bank said, and now they've done what the World Bank said, and they've closed their ears to what their people wanted and instead instituted these shock doctrine policies. Now you're blaming the government for being undemocratic, which is, of course, what you provided them a financial incentive to do in the first place. So definitely, I think, you know, shrinking the size of loans and absolutely sort of writing off a great deal of debt is a way of firstly making that aid more effective, but secondly to be able to foster the kind of democracy I think that we both want.
So there has been a lot of debt forgiveness in the past few years. Tony Blair made it one of his priorities when Britain was heading the G8.
Mm.
Do you think that that's just not been enough?
It hasn't been enough, and of course it's been the debt forgiveness was also kind of spiked because it was only given to countries that had implemented a shock doctrine policy. So I definitely think that there's room for much more substantial debt forgiveness. And in the cases where it has worked, by the way, it's worked very well indeed. You know, there was a sort of nuts argument that countries who were, you know, who had debt relief would go out and spend it on flat screen TVs or something. But in fact, governments have been absolutely ready to spend on social sector stuff, on healthcare, on education, on the sorts of development policies that they were prevented from, you know, because they had to repay the debt. Well, debt forgiveness has been shown to work, but it just needs to happen a great deal more and more rapidly.
Do you think that there should be conditionality on debt forgiveness in terms of governance and institutional reform? This is the new buzzword of development, right? Institutions matter.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's interesting that they finally recognize that they do. It's, you know, I mean, in a sense, of course, it's the sort of thing that people in those institutions were pointing out 20, 30 years ago. But it's nice that people in Washington have kind of twigged on to that. But I mean, I think that there's some space for conditions if those conditions are about participation and about transparency. I don't think that there's room for conditions if those conditions actually dictate what the policy is going to be. So I mean, I certainly think sort of participation and transparency conditions aren't bad ones to have if you're going to have them. But in terms of debt forgiveness, you know, a lot of this debt was incurred by illegitimate regimes that were absolutely unaccountable. And at the end of the day, just writing them off, without any provisions, is going to be a very good step forward.
Well, I think that, you know, part of the problem, right, is there's no bankruptcy procedure for governments. Mm. You can't. There's no way to say, well, you know. But I mean, I do think that there are some questions that I would have here. I mean, in part, I'm just not sure. Sometimes I just think that the World Bank shouldn't make loans. I mean, you know, if you're going to give people money, give them grants.
Right.
But, you know, there's this issue of having loans. When a bank gives me a loan, right, for a mortgage, mm-hmm. it wants to know that I'm going to have some reasonable probability of paying it back. And
right.
so it says things like you have to insure the house, you have to buy mortgage insurance, and so forth. And that doesn't see, you know, to the extent that the policies really do make it easier for the country in the future to pay the loans back, that doesn't necessarily seem unreasonable to me. The question that I would have is how well do they actually do that? Because, you know, you've got – Nigeria is a good example. You know, mm-hmm. after the petrodollars dried up in the early 80s and the World Bank came in and did this – you know, just what we've been talking about. They gave them money to sort of tide them over and put conditions on it. Mm-hmm. And so Nigeria implements all these reforms. Well, you know, the man on the street now associates the IMF – program with the decline, and in fact that, you know, the economic decline was the fact that the price of oil had just plummeted. Mm-hmm. But you know, you undercut that support for the institutions that you're trying to build up, because you've now sort of ineradicably associated in people's minds trade liberalization equals economic decline. And I think that that's actually been a continuing problem in a lot of developing countries, is that because the IMF and the World Bank only really come in when there's an emergency, mm-hmm. people associate the policies that they push, that I think often are good policies, with the emergency rather than sort of, you know, with, you know, trying to mitigate the emergency.
Well, that's it. But again, what happens in those emergency situations is that governments are faced with a sort of financial choice about, well, do we spend on social programs to take the edge off the current crisis, or do we engage in some tough and painful structural reform right now and just make the, you know, exacerbate the emergency in the short term, but in the long term we'll be able to cure things with the patient. And I think, you know, the democratic thing to do is to actually listen to what people are saying and to provide a sort of route for people to be able to have the edge taken off the crisis, and then, you know, engage in the long-term process of institution building as a sort of democratic dialogue. And incidentally, I mean, I think that problem is something that we're seeing today, right now, because, you know, we are in the middle of the return of the food riot. I mean, the food riot has sort of been a constant throughout human history. But it's interesting that it's come back now, because in fact there've been a number of food riots, and the food riots are kind of an interesting way of looking at sort of crisis and the World Bank and international development policies. Now, throughout history, two things characterize food riots. On the one hand, you have a rapid entitlement gap, a gap between what people believe that should be theirs by such dint of just what, you know, their expectations, and what they can actually afford. So, you know, in times of a huge price increase, for example, you'll have this expectation gap. But then also the other sort of magic ingredient in a food riot is a lack of democracy. Because people take to the streets and protest about food only when there is no other way of making their voices heard, when the markets have failed and when, you know, mechanisms of accountability have failed. So if you look at food riots more recently, I mean, for example, the food riots that happened in the United States in 1917, you'll see precisely those two things at work. You have, in 1917, a huge price spike that happened at the end of the First World War. So American housewives, for example, found it very hard to put meals on the table. But at the same time, in 1917, those American housewives couldn't vote. And so you're seeing, they took to the streets demanding not only bread, but the franchise. And that those demands were actually very successful in motivating governments to not only take the edge off the price spikes, but also to provide to actually strengthen democracy by letting women vote, which is what happened, what was ratified in 1920. So the food riots today are both demands for food and demands for government accountability, and that's the one thing that kind of the World Bank takes away when it comes in and imposes these policies in a crisis, and that's why people are now on the streets, because these governments have followed bank doctrine rather than listen to their people. These governments are no longer accountable in any meaningful way, and that's why people feel that there's no way for them to articulate their grievances about prices other than by taking to the streets. And so you've had riots now in dozens of countries around the world, and in countries where democracy has been shaky and often where bank policies have been followed to the letter.
I wonder, though, if World Bank aid in general, I mean, you know, there's this argument basically that, any economist is familiar with the idea of the resource curse, which is that when you have revenue from a natural, for viewers who may not be familiar with it, when you have revenue from something like oil or diamonds, it's basically just a natural endowment. It doesn't do well for the country. It has a couple of problems. First, it ups the exchange rate, which makes it harder to export. But second of all, it gives the government a source of unaccountable funds. And when people aren't paying taxes, the government is less accountable. You know, they don't watch the government as closely. And so the government is less accountable, and you get more corruption and worse institutions, and no economic growth is ultimately the problem. And instead of investing in productive capacity, whether in agriculture or manufacturing, people just spend all of their time fighting over the rents from these resources. Mm-hmm. And there's an argument that's actually looking stronger that aid can function as a resource curse.
Yes.
That it does raise the exchange rate, and it also gives the government a source of money that isn't accountable to the people. So I completely agree with you there. I guess my question is, how do you get around that? My idea, because I'm a libertarian, would be just the World Bank should start bypassing the governments, and the World Bank should be, to the extent that we have the World Bank, rather than, say, breaking it up into a bunch of different aid organizations. I would first say some of this stuff just shouldn't be loans. Like, when you talk about social spending, I agree with you that, you know, it's a good thing to prevent Venezuelans from starving or not being able to go to school when they're in the middle of a crisis. But I don't see lending people money for that. It's not like if we keep people from starving, they're going to now be able to necessarily repay the loan. You know, that's just humanitarian, and they should get humanitarian relief for that stuff. And the structural reform money, I don't have a problem with structural reform, but that money should be aimed at the structural reform, the mechanisms of the government that need reform. Things like the pension system in Brazil that sort of keep dragging the government down, and it still hasn't, as far as I know, managed to fix. So how do you give the government money without making it less accountable and less democratic?
Well, I think debt forgiveness has to be a big part of this, because governments, when they're hooked on vast loans that cycle through, as you say, these rents are ones that the governments can basically thieve with impunity. And so definitely shrinking the size of the loan is a great start. But then you raise a very interesting question. Well, what do you do with a corrupt government? How do you get the money in? Now, Jeffrey Sachs, bless him, has a series of projects going on where he has villages in Africa that he's sort of creating a network of villages that are having vast amounts of money that are being infused into those villages to create better healthcare, better schools, what have you. And, you know, the indicators seem to show that with large applications, you know, sort of increasing aid 100-fold to these villages, things get better. But unfortunately, the result has been that because the government has been largely bypassed in this, and also the village traditional structures have been largely bypassed, the effect has been to create a shadow government, and to create a sort of networks of people who have access to the aid who are not even democratically accountable. And that would be my very great worry about any attempt by the World Bank to avoid governments, because the only thing that's worse than going through a government is not going through a government, precisely because they are not accountable, and there are no structures in this sort of shadow government for aid within Jeffrey Sachs's little villages to be able to hold anyone to account, and that I think is a little worse than having a government that at least on paper has has some mechanisms for accountability, even if it treats those mechanisms as toilet paper rather than anything else.
Should we give money to a country like Zimbabwe?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think certainly sort of food aid purchased from Zimbabweans and distributed within the region, purchased within the region and distributed to Zimbabwe is very important.
I was about to say.
Sorry. let's take it to Zimbabwe and give it away. No, I'm sorry. purchased within the region. And in fact, this is important because U.S. Title II food aid doesn't allow that. The way food aid works in the United States is that U.S. food aid...
It's completely moronic.
It is a little mad. For viewers who don't know, it is that they must... U.S. Food aid has to be from U.S. farmers and shipped on a U.S. carrier to halfway around the world. Now, this may seem like an act of deep and selfless generosity, but actually the problem is that when you take U.S. food aid and you dump it into an economy where the poorest people, bear in mind, are farmers who are struggling very hard to be able to get a crop going and try and sell it in the local market, well, when you bring in food aid from the States and give it away for free, you nuke those farmers and you wipe them out entirely. And that's been a sort of constant problem with food aid, and a lot of aid agencies are shifting away from the U.S. policy to a regional purchasing policy, because in every major famine since the Second World War, there has always been food. The problem is that the rich have managed to buy it up and hoard it and speculate on its future increase, while the poor have been denied the chance to eat it. So I certainly think that in Zimbabwe, food aid is definitely a problem, and there's definitely something needs to happen. I don't know. I mean, I would be very skeptical about giving anything to the Zimbabwean government. But I think also carrying on with the kinds of loans that are being given to the Zimbabwean government is also a very bad idea, because again, you're providing an opportunity for rents there. And I think one of the ways to create a freer Zimbabwe is to encourage debt forgiveness and encourage support for civil society within Zimbabwe.
So we should probably move on to the developed world, but before we do, I'd actually like to ask, this is something I've been wondering about, and I haven't been able to, find any sort of good information on it. There's been a long-standing argument in the development community about whether food aid is a good idea, because, of course, it helps urban workers, but it impoverishes the farmers, just as you say. Is the current crisis helping? And the farmers, by the way, for viewers, are always the poorest people in these societies, almost always the poorest people in these societies. And so you're actually, taking from the very badly off to give the slightly less badly off,
right.
Is usually the criticism of sort of lower, the people who criticize lowering trade barriers because it protects farmers. So are the farmers benefiting from this in Africa and in other developing countries?
Well, it's still very much in play. It's a great question, because it's not entirely clear who has the upper hand here. I mean, in every crisis, there are any number of people who sort of pipe up with the solution, whether that solution is to feed everyone just a single kind of crop, or to carry on with the shock therapy because the crisis is because the shock therapy hasn't been administered completely enough. Certainly farmers' movements are making their case, but it's not clear to me that particularly small and sustainable farms are necessarily getting the attention that's due. And I think that's one of one of the ways that we'll get out of this crisis is by paying attention to them. And the longer the longer we stay in this crisis, I think the greater the chances of doing that. But there's everything in play.
But at a basic level, is this raising farm incomes with the rising food prices, or is it mostly going to middlemen?
In Stuffed and Starved, I have this sort of diagram of what I call the bottleneck, where there's millions of farmers over here, and billions of consumers here, and just a handful of corporations in the middle. Now, when the price of food goes up, certainly farm gate prices have increased. But the model to think about is not of sort of farmers sitting on piles of cash and driving Bentleys, but thinking about more of the oil industry. I mean, when the price of oil goes up, we don't for a moment think that the people who benefit from that are oil workers. We understand that they might get a cut, but the people who really are making the money are the speculators and the mega corporations in the middle. And I think that that's the case with this particular crisis too. And in fact, there are two reasons to think that. First, if you look at the futures markets, there seems to be a bubble in food. There seems to be sort of exaggerated speculation in food, and everyone's driving the price up. And at the same time...
I should say that people have been talking about an exaggerated bubble in, that speculative bubble in oil for the last 5 years, and it doesn't seem to have popped yet.
No, exactly. But the housing market is really the market to think about here, where the price of houses went through the roof to do with nothing about the houses themselves or about housing, about the availability of houses, but to do with people's expectations about the future price. And that's the bubble that seems to be happening with food right now.
So you don't think I sort of buy the argument that Chinese demand, especially Chinese demand for meat, and in broader Asia is pushing up the price. In there's an actual demand increase coming up against a short-term fixed supply. Do you not think that's true?
Well, I certainly think the meat consumption. In fact, we should talk about meat. But I think that demand for meat is certainly driving up the price of food. But most of that, it seems to me nuts to think that all of a sudden last year a bunch of Chinese people decided, wouldn't it be nice to have pork? And all of a sudden they have been responsible for the cataclysm that is among on us now. And sadly, if you read a lot of the US press, it is inflected with a certain kind of racism about the Chinese wanting pork or the Indians wanting milk or what have you. It's the Asians, damn them, that are responsible for the situation.
I didn't mean it that way.
No, I didn't. But if you look at the newspapers, and if one's sensitive at all to the kinds of ways in which foreigners get blamed for things. One doesn't have to go very far. President Bush this weekend blamed India and the Indian middle class for the astounding demand for food that's happening and the food crisis. It seems to me nuts that 50 million people, which is the size of the Indian middle class, could be responsible for the kinds of cataclysm that we're seeing around the world. And yet there's an impulse to blame them rather to look a little closer to home. Because
there's stupid ethanol subsidies.
And our stupid ethanol subsidies, but also actually the amount of meat that gets consumed in this country is unsustainable. There isn't enough planet to provide enough land to feed the livestock that's required to give everyone the same kind of meat consumption that's happening and that the United States has, and that's not something that gets raised. Instead, it is the Asians who get blamed for wanting to have a little bit more meat in their diet. I mean, not much, but just a little. It's been going over the past 20 years incrementally. It's not just one last year, but a little bit more every year. And all of a sudden, now it's reached a sort of tipping point where people are ready to sort of point fingers about it.
See, I would say, to me, despite the fact that I'm a vegan, to me it's a glad sign that there are people in China and India who are getting wealthier and can afford to eat more. But at the same time, it's sad that the people they're competing with are mostly extremely poor Africans, or that's at least how it seems to me.
Well, again, to me, it's interesting that there's this idea that in Asia people are doing generally doing very well, but of course Asia has the world's largest number of people who are hungry, and the Asian Development Bank was saying that billions will are going to be going hungry. It's certainly, for me, it's an issue about class. It's about people who can afford to eat meat, and therefore who can, through the market, send a signal to that grains are better put into livestock than into people. And that's the market at work and doing as it should. But it does mean that because the market is the only way that people on low incomes get to eat, the people on the lowest incomes don't get to eat at all. And that, to me, is the tragedy here, is that despite Asia's increased wealth, and you know, India, for example, is the country with the largest number of people in the Forbes top 10 billionaires list, and India is also the country with the world's largest number of people with type 2 diabetes, and it's the world's largest democracy in the world, many things, but there's this sort of range of contradictions that when we have such wealth, at the same time that wealth means that other people go hungry, and it's not being redistributed in ways that it used to be.
You know, I'm normally skeptical of the argument that, you know, that the U.S. is rich because other people are poor. I think, you know, most countries are poor because they have sort of low endowments for various reasons. But I think that in this case, it's pretty clear that, you know, wealthy people in Asia, and the Asian middle class, and, you know, wealthy people in the developed world are clearly bidding up the grain beyond the price that very poor people can pay right now, especially for incredibly dumb things like ethanol. And, you know, this is actually a case where, you know, when you're hitting up against resource constraints in the short term, it really is obviously, and I think you're right also in the long term, that obviously we are not all in the world going to be able to consume meat at American levels. Which is actually probably a good segue to go on to the other half of your book, which is the problem of obesity in the developed world.
And,
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, but in fact, you know, it's not just the developed world that has obesity. I mean, certainly the United States is the world's most obese country. Only 3 out of 10 Americans now have a normal body weight, and everyone else is either overweight or obese. But the second most obese country in the world is a developing one. It's Mexico. And in fact, there's in Stuffed and Starved, I sort of dug up this figure in a medical journal where the closer in Mexico, the closer you get to the United States border, the fatter Mexican teenagers are likely to be. And it's it seems very interesting to me that if that's the case, then we need to be looking sociologically for reasons and looking sort of at a social level for reasons for obesity rather than blaming it on individual merits or individual lack of will. Sorry, will you excuse me for a second? I thought
no,
I switched
absolutely.
The phone on. Okay, hang on a sec. Sorry about that. My mother-in-law is on the phone, and she switched it back on.
I'm not surprised to hear that that Mexico gets fatter as it gets closer to the U.S. because, of course, it also gets richer as it gets closer to
that's
the U.S.
True.
But I do
yeah.
think that there is an enormous.
Hang on a second.
Sure.
Sorry, quick instruction on how to leave the phone off the hook. okay, now all is well.
It's a freeform jazz odyssey here. I think that there's this tremendous moralism about weight,
yes.
Especially in America, that is sort of it's terrible because you know I think I've realized certainly that I don't have much trouble keeping weight off, and that. What people describe to me who are overweight about what's going on in their head just doesn't happen in my head. Mm-hmm. Like, when I'm hungry, I can get hungry enough to be desperate for food, but it's usually after I haven't eaten for 8 hours or something,
right.
And then all I can think about is food. And in them, it seems like every 2 hours, all they can think about is food. And also that they just clearly crave food. And also when people talk about, you know, I feel sad, so I had a pint of ice cream. Like, ice cream doesn't make me feel less sad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't eat it when I'm sad. And I think that there's something going on in their brains that's just clearly different from what happens in my brain in reaction to food, and my whole family is thin. And, And that, you know, to say that this is some sort of, you know, triumph of my willpower is like I'm not working that hard to overcome my desire to eat a pint of ice cream in
right,
a sitting.
Right.
And you know, that I absolutely agree with you that this is, you know, the way that we frame it is just as this, well, if people in America just tried a little harder, they would be thin, and I don't think that that's right. So what is your theory about what's happening?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Again, one of the things in Stuffed and Starved that I found was the Atkins diet, you know, the first edition of the Atkins diet. Robert Atkins spends a very long time trying to assess what's going on. And he has this tirade against the sugar industry, where he's saying big sugar is poisoning us, and you know, we're being forced to eat too much sugar, and it's in our food. We don't even know it's there. And yet, you know, this is happening around America and around the world. So he frames this very social issue and a political issue about the power of large corporations to adulterate our food. But his solution is not to take on those corporations, but to follow the Atkins diet. And that, you know, that to me sort of points to the sort of individualizing impulse that's around, when clearly we all understand that there's a bigger social problem at work here. And I think, you know, the fault is, is easy to see in terms of it's being socially driven. Just look at the architecture of communities, in communities of people who are working class, for example, in the United States. They have less access to green space. They have proportionally more liquor stores and fast food restaurants. And they have those because they are working so much harder, running between two jobs to be able to get healthcare that everything, you know, people in the rest of the industrialized world takes for granted, running around and trying to take care of kids and what have you, that all of a sudden the fast food becomes convenient. It's a sort of social construct that the fast food and liquor stores become the sort of meccas of convenient food, because supermarkets won't go in there. There is no green, you know, green space, and there's certainly fresh fruits and vegetables are much harder to find, say, in West Oakland, just across the bay here, than they are in San Francisco. So there are some very big social processes going on that constrain people's choices and reduce people's choices to choices between Burger King or McDonald's. But you know, choosing between Coke and Pepsi isn't, you know, if that's the full spectrum of your choice, then that's no choice at all. So I certainly think that there's an issue here about freedom that is, I think, kind of swept away under the rug, because instead of freedom, what gets talked about is the ambit of consumer choice. Now, on top of that, there is pervasive marketing, and I think this is a way of getting to the question about, well, what's going on in people's heads when, you know, when they're made what induces them to buy so much food? Well, there's just a lot of food marketing in the world today. For every dollar that is spent encouraging us to eat food that is healthy for us, $500 is spent promoting junk food, and that's a global figure. That's why globally, the McDonald's Golden Arches are more widely recognized than the Christian Cross. Because there is, you know, there is such this huge amount of money that is spent on media around food, and of course that media flips both ways. It not only promotes the consumption of food that is obese, but it also promotes some unhealthy body images. Because the example I have in the book is quite horrifying. In 1995, in Fiji, they couldn't get TV from America, but in 1995, U.S. terrestrial television was beamed in. And from 1995 to 1999, the rate of bulimia for Fijian adolescents went from 0 to 12% in 4 years. The only thing that happened in that country was the airing of U.S. terrestrial television. So that gives a sort of a sense of how much our media-infused lives. I'm discounting blogging heads here, how much our media-infused lives are inducements both to consume certain kinds of food and also to have certain kinds of images of what we are, what we should look like in our heads. And it's no wonder that neuroses result as a consequence.
Well, see, I think here is where the libertarian starts pushing back.
Uh-huh.
So, I think I would say that, you know, I don't. I don't see the supermarkets as the problem for obesity, simply because, you know, if you look at the trend, supermarkets have got, even in working-class neighborhoods, which I agree that in poor neighborhoods, the supermarkets aren't as good. You know, I lived sort of across the street from a housing project in New York, mm-hmm. and the supermarket that I went to there was very much, you know, low selection of produce, smaller, sort of dimmer, dirtier than the ones, you know, sort of a little farther down Columbus Avenue where more affluent people shopped. But that said, those supermarkets have still gotten better than they were in the 70s, but people are only getting fatter. And you know, similarly, poor people, you know, many of them work extremely hard, but they are working fewer hours than they used to.
I'm not sure that's true.
In 1970. Yeah, it's actually it's interesting. Like for the first time in American history, rich people work more hours than poor people do by quite a lot. And so I think that I don't see those as an explanation for the trend. I mean, I see them as potential areas of improvement, but I don't necessarily think that the issue is, for example, that you know, companies put sugar in products because people like sugar, and they've always liked sugar.
Right.
You know, my grandmother, who never, you know, used a mix in her life, we had pie or cookies or so forth, and sugar is just cheaper than it used to be, and especially high fructose corn syrup. Mm-hmm. I think maybe, you know, one area that we could talk about is the way that that our farm policy basically diverts sugar consumption into high fructose corn syrup. Mm-hmm. But I want to leave that for a minute because I also want to push back a little bit on marketing to say that, you know, it's not clear to me that the marketing, there's good evidence that advertising and marketing switches people within categories or that it gets them to consume foods they didn't know existed. But I haven't found, and I've asked, you know, several people like Eric Schlosser and Benjamin Barber, as well as looking on my own, I haven't found any evidence that advertising actually increases people's consumption. So I think there's something different going on here, and I do think it has to do with food processing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has to do with sort of a bad situation where you've got companies, I don't see it as a conspiracy, but rather that they're making their food more standard and more palatable.
Right.
And there's some, you know, this idea of like hyper palatability, that the food is so good that you just can't eat one Dorito.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically there's this guy, Seth Roberts, who's a psychologist, who has a theory that having food that's very similar very frequently primes our bodies to raise the natural set point that it wants to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
For most people, not for everyone. There are obviously some people who are just naturally always thin. Their bodies don't want to retain calories. But that for most people, you know, eating what he calls these ditto foods basically raises the set point and just ups people's appetite so that they eat more. And, of course, it's sort of a vicious cycle, right? You mm-hmm. go out and buy more Doritos, and your body says, aha, look at all these wonderful calories that are around. It must be the harvest season. Eat more.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I do think that, you know, one of the interesting things is what Michael Pollan in his Omnivore's Dilemma, which I've just started reading, is how dominant corn is. And I think it's really interesting that Mexico is the second most obese country, because that is obviously also the place where corn is second most dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, you would think that Mexicans would, when you look at the isotopes in their blood, you would think that Mexicans would be the people with the highest corn consumption. And in fact, it's Americans. He says we look like walking corn chips.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because our agricultural policy, basically, and I will go with you here and side against the corporations at the behest of people like ADM.
Mm.
We have subsidized and protected our way into growing gigantic, vast quantities of corn that then get fed to these industrially farmed cows mm-hmm. and pigs and chickens, and it all ends up in our food chain. And that there may be something about corn that makes it sort of make you more fat than other kinds of foodstuffs. That wouldn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
So I will now give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, no, but I think you're right. I wish, firstly, that I had a curve for the amount of marketing that was, you know, the amount of dollars spent on marketing food, because I think that would be a way of getting out, you know, getting rid of the noise in terms of how much consumption was due to increases in marketing versus other things. I mean, I'll certainly post up research. I'll dig around on that, and if I find anything, it'll be up at stuffedandstarved.org. But, I mean, I agree with you, actually. I mean, I think if you look at the sort of the curve for obesity, although it has always been a preoccupation in the United States, I mean, even as early as the 1950s, there were analysts who were looking at the data coming from the Metropolitan Life Insurance Agency, looking at sort of weight and height and noticing that Americans were becoming more obese, and there was this sort of big hue and cry in the 1950s about this. But really, it only starts in the 1970s, and you know, which is the dawn, really, of high fructose corn syrup. And certainly, you know, corporations, I mean, because the profit motive is kind of king here, while marketing does sort of, it certainly normalizes things that, again, Michael Pollan calls food-like substances. I mean, marketing makes us believe that things that our great-grandparents would have laughed at in terms of food and then recoiled and then been appalled at watching us eat, well, those things have become normal. And advertising is certainly a way of normalizing some very odd things indeed. And if you pick up the wrapper of any of, you know, pick your favorite processed food. I mean, it's like you know, the sort of fine print on a legal document, with the number of ingredients sort of stretching out into the dozens, and that food processing is designed to make us to make this food more resonant with what our bodies are hardwired to enjoy, which is, you know, salts and fats and sugars. And processing is becoming the kind of art of being able to disguise and blend the salts and the fats and the sugars so that we do consume more. I couldn't agree with you more that those are the kinds of foods that we are induced to consume. And of course, again, if we're working hard, I'm curious about the figure of working Americans, because the figures that I've seen show that in real terms since the 1980s working American wages have declined,
the interesting thing is that at least Eric Hurst at Chicago argues that those are flip sides of the same thing, is that people, because the real wages for basically unskilled workers have declined, those people are choosing to work less. It's a rational trade-off between leisure and work when you get paid less per hour. And then the work leisure trade off starts to look like, you know, your supply curve shifts and you want to supply less labor to the market.
That seems to me a little mad. If, for example, the people who are making that trade off also have kids to feed, and often they do. Just looking at the history of how this has played out in terms of, you know, any serious human society, when wages go down, people who are poor and have no alternative super exploit themselves to be able to sustain a level of consumption that lets them live, rather than sort of lie back on a bale of grass and chew straw. So
I think that that's definitely true in societies that are below sort of a level of subsistence. Mm-hmm. But there's Charles Corrales is actually, I just went to a lunch with him at the World Bank last week. He's got an interesting theory about this, is that once you've hit that there's basically this space between sort of misery and sufficiency, that people react to differently. So if you're not actually starving, right, if you've got sort of enough food and a roof over your head and so forth, but you don't see a way to get yourself to the point where you're actually going to be satisfied. So it's between sufficiency and satisfaction, I guess, is a better way to put it.
Right.
He likens it to like having, you know, if you have a new car and you get one dent in it, you want to go get the dent fixed because it makes your car look terrible.
Right.
You've got a car with sort of 97 dents in it and you get one more, why would you fix that dent? It just doesn't make sense. And so, you know, in America, you're not dealing usually with people who are actually going to starve if they work less. You're dealing with people who may not have as many clothes or so forth. And that at that level, people are making sort of, at least Eric Hurst argues, a rational decision to exit the labor market rather than work more hours for less pay. But I completely agree with you that in anywhere like Africa or Asia or anywhere where it's actually a question of your children not eating, that people indeed do hyper-exploit themselves.
But then it's interesting to think about where that moment of sufficiency versus satisfaction occurs. Because in the United States, again in a good year, 35.5 million Americans were food insecure. And that was in 2006. We can certainly expect that number to increase today, what with the credit crisis, the recession, the decline in household income, the increase in food prices. We can expect that number to go up. Now, of those 35.5 million, there is a hardcore that is in the United States, chronically food insecure. And that, you know, those people to me seem to be at most risk from actually becoming obese. And I haven't seen the figures for the United States, but I have seen them for Spain. Spain has a very interesting sort of profile for obesity, where the top 10% of the population in terms of income, the richest 10%, are half as likely to be obese as the bottom 10%. And that seems to me to have a lot to do with the pace of the working day, the kinds of foods that are available to be eaten in short order. And you know, the way that fast food and processed food is the most convenient when you're working very long hours, which is what certainly the poorest 10% of Spaniards do. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there was some sort of link between the increase that we're seeing now in hunger and increases in levels of diet-related disease like diabetes, for example.
Well, I think the food insufficiency number in the United States, which is I don't know about Spain, but it's sort of misleading because food insecurity doesn't mean actually missing a meal, and most of those people haven't missed a meal; they just worried about missing a meal, and even of the core who missed a meal, and you're not talking about malnourishment, you're talking about people who maybe in the course of a year skipped two meals because they didn't have money for food. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm saying that's a good thing, but it's not the same as sort of African levels, and it might be enough to get people I'm very sure that the poor work fewer hours than the wealthy, mm-hmm. in part because if you know, things like being disabled make you more likely to be poor. It's not entirely.
Right, okay, yeah, yeah.
But I also do think that there is sort of a rational choice to, mm-hmm. to you know, and I don't know that I, if all I were going to make was $5.25 an hour, would I enter the labor force? I don't mm-hmm. know. You know, mm-hmm. If I was already kind of getting by, I don't know.
Right.
But I think that my explanation would be a couple of things. Is first of all that sociologically, obesity is like, white upper middle class Americans are the most hysterical about being fat in the country. They're the most moralistic about it. They are the people who are most likely to find women who are overweight completely unattractive. And they are just absolutely the most sort of afraid of getting overweight. Mm. And so that's one part of it, right? Is if there's a huge social stigma attached to being overweight, you are more likely to sort of avoid the behaviors that might make you overweight, right? You're going to eat fewer Doritos. You're not going to have as many of those ditto foods that Seth Roberts talks about. Mm. I think there's another component to it, which is that, people who are working, you basically get, if you're an upper middle class woman who's working, you can afford a higher level of pre-prepared meals, mm-hmm. right? So you've already got this social obsession with, and in some ways I think very healthy social obsession with vegetables and so forth, but you can get like a really nice pre-prepared roast chicken and salads and so forth at the supermarket, whereas if you were a working mom who's coming home tired after a long day and you only make $10 an hour, what you can afford is Denny's. Mm. And so that, there's a difference between what people eat, even if the behavior isn't actually different, if
right.
that makes sense.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
And I think there are other things, there are educational things about I don't want to overstress that because the fact is, like my grandparents were the first people in their families to graduate from high school, mm-hmm. and they knew what made you fat. Mm-hmm. They knew that like eating fatty, sugary things would make you gain weight. Mm. But I've talked to some people who, for example, do outreach in the Hispanic community in New York, and mm-hmm. the frustration that they have is that they're going out to people and giving them information and giving them education and saying like, and what they say is most of these people are from countries where they actually, they're used to cooking a low fat, high fiber, mostly vegetable based diet, mm. which is what these people from Colombia and so forth are trying to get back in. But the immigrants don't want that. First of all, they want meat. It's a status good. Mm-hmm. And they feel like they're entitled to it. And I think to a certain extent, most people really like meat. It tastes good, so they want to eat it. And what the meat that they can afford is the meat from the chicken place or the meat from McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a voluntary choice. I mean, I think it's too pat to say that it's just being done to people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that we all still want these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I agree with you that I think that there is a systemic problem and that the way that the market works the food processing industry, right, it has all sorts of good things. We don't have malnourishment in this country because we have cheap food, and that's fantastic. And, you know, frozen vegetables and all of these things have made enormous gains, improvements in people's lives. The downside of that is that processed food, I think, does sort of activate some evolutionary pathways that are turning out not to be so good for us. But my, you know, my hesitation is twofold. Is first of all, I hesitate to get around and start grotting around in markets unless I'm really, really sure about what I'm doing. And I don't really see a way to fix this problem with some sort of like government intervention. And the second part problem is that I'm leery of how paternalistic it is for me to say, like, look, I am obsessed with, you know, having a healthy, green-filled diet. You must share that obsession, and if you don't share that obsession, and if you try to choose fast food, I'm going to take it away from you because I know what's best.
Well, I mean, how do you feel about a tobacco tax?
I'm against it.
Okay.
For the same reason, I think that you know, people know that smoking gives you cancer, and if they choose to smoke anyway, it's not my job to tell them not to do that.
Okay, despite the fact that tobacco is addictive. Or nicotine is.
Yeah, I smoked, and, like, quitting wasn't that... You know, I mean, like, I smoked a lot. I smoked a pack and a half a day for 8 years. And quitting wasn't pleasant, but it also wasn't impossible. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something that you can't choose to do.
No, sure. I mean, I went through similar pain, and I had a hell of a time quitting. And, in fact, there's still, you know, there are days where I still... dying for a cigarette, even though I haven't had one in years. But I'm sympathetic.
I mean,
to that,
I actually think that the tobacco is kind of different from food in the sense that going cold turkey is a lot easier than carrying a match.
No, I think so. But the reason I raise the example of tobacco is because of a finding that just came out in PLOS Medicine that draws on some of what you're saying. But by the way, I agree with a great deal of what you're saying. But there is a public health issue here, particularly in the United States. You're right that you're not seeing people whose bellies are distended from hunger in the United States, but you are seeing people whose bellies are distended, and those bellies that's because of overnutrition and overconsumption, and it's already starting to catch up with us. The journal PLOS Medicine a couple of weeks back, it was shown that women, particularly in the United States and particularly in rural areas, have a reduced life expectancy now because of the diseases associated with diet and with smoking and what have you, heart disease and diabetes being the chief among them.
Yeah, one thing I hadn't realized actually was that the female advantage over males in life expectancy is smoking. It's not it's not some special. They just smoke at lower rates, and so they die at lower rates. but sorry, go on.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that's certainly part of it, though. I hope that medical viewers, medically trained viewers, and epidemiologists who are watching will write in and comment on that. But I also think that it's it's interesting if we're concerned about the effects of diet, in the same way that there is a smoking tax, and you know I'm kind of down. I think smoking is the smoking tax is a very good idea, and that was part of what helped me to quit, was the fact that it became unaffordable to carry on behaving in a very bad way. I think that similarly, when it comes to diet, food that is going to be bad for you, and that we know and we can predict in advance is going to be bad for you, is a sort of thing that probably ought to carry a price tag with it that reflects the true cost. I mean, I think if we want the markets to work in general, if we want the markets to actually perform their function as best they can in terms of making resources distributed according to according to true cost, then true cost has to be factored into everything. So the true cost, for example, of producing food using fossil fuels, the true cost of producing food that is obesogenic that will result in higher medical bills, the true the social cost of food that relies on exploitation or low wage labor. Those sorts of things, I think, need to feature in the price. Otherwise, people can't make an informed and reasonable decision about how to spend their money. And unfortunately, the way our food comes to us today, again, sort of reaching back to the Archer Daniels Midland example, is built built on systems of subsidy and distortion of markets that have very little to do with the true cost and have everything to do with how deeply into the government's pockets a few corporations have been able to insinuate themselves. So I certainly think that there's a role for true cost pricing in order to make markets work better. And I think we can both agree on that, can't we?
Well, I guess I would separate this out into a couple of different questions. First of all, I am a firm supporter of a high carbon tax. So I think we're probably both on the same page there, is that when things get produced using petrochemicals, when things get trucked long distances, when they get refrigerated, et cetera, the carbon that is emitted into the atmosphere should be priced into that.
Absolutely.
I think that that's a subsidy to our food that we don't need. And the second thing I would say is that the subsidies and the protections and all of it should be gone. Mm-hmm. U.S. agriculture, trade should be completely free. The sugar industry and the corn industry, two of the most vile farm lobbies in America, should be the first to go. So I think we can definitely agree on those two things there. And actually, a third thing that I would say is that I would like people to be more aware of how meat is industrially farmed and what that really looks like. Then, on the other hand, though, I would say I have a couple problems with the idea of taxing people. And the first is this, that I am uncomfortable intervening and deciding that people's choices... that there's some true cost. They're bearing the cost. Mm-hmm. If they get fat and die young, they've chosen to bear that cost. I dispute that the government, when the government first provides my health care and then tells me that I have to change my behavior because I'm making that health care too expensive, that bothers me. And I don't think that that's something that the state should be entitled to do. And then the third part of it is that to the extent that you're saving people, right? So you quit smoking. Mm-hmm. The weird thing is that most of the people who quit smoking because of New York's smoking tax seem to be upper middle class. Mm. And the people who didn't are poor people. So, you're helping you quit smoking. But the people who are paying for that are the people who are least able to pay these taxes. And I think that that's also obviously going to be true to the extent that the poor consume more junk food. That is also going to be true of them. That we may help some poor people, but we're basically helping them by levying a tax on other poor people, and that just seems distributionally strange to me.
It is distributionally strange, but the data in the UK looks very different. I mean, it's certainly true that taxes on cigarettes are regressive, because there is an association with there's a link between low income and smoking. But with an incremental increase in tax, it is also true that in the UK at least, that has been seen to be a factor that's resulted in increased numbers of people giving up.
I'm not disputing that, by the way. I think you raise the cost of something and people consume less.
Exactly. I think you're asking exactly the right question. Is this a tax on poor people? I mean, is a junk food tax really a tax on working people, and is that distributionally weird? I think that it has the possibility of doing that, but of course, because I'm okay with taxation, I can say that the taxes that are levied here need to be redistributed in terms of a food aid program, so to make sure that working people and the poorest people in society get to eat and get to eat healthily. And I think that's a position I think you would find objectionable.
Well, I'm not like a libertarian tax nut. I have very strong opinions about tax policy, but they have much more to do with. I in general favor lower government spending, but I also think that to the extent that we redistribute money, we should just redistribute cash to people and let them figure out how they want to spend it. So I'm a big proponent of Milton Friedman's negative income tax. And I think that we should get rid of welfare programs, except for people who are actually physically or cognitively disabled. Get rid of welfare programs, get rid of food aid programs, not get rid of, except again, like in a one little circumstance, which would be pregnant women and women with new infants. Because I think we have sort of a vested interest in making sure that that those women are eating nutritionally. But mostly would focus on, to the extent that people are not able to, if that their labor does not provide them what we consider sort of a basic decent life as Americans, I think that what we should do is make their labor profitable for them in terms of, a tax on their, a sort of reverse tax on their hours that gives them more money, just tops up their wages, rather than trying to you know, choose what they eat, choose how they consume healthcare, choose, you know, choose what they should be consuming. You know, I want to give the poor as much autonomy and treat them not like children.
Yes.
Which that's the fundamental problem that I have with a lot of this stuff is that it's, well, you know, we need to find you a house because you're too stupid or, you know, you'll blow all the money on a satellite dish. And in some sense, like, that may be true because most people, when they get money, they, you know, you go through a learning process of having, you know, you get your first job in college and then you blow all your money on, like, a new TV and then you realize you don't have any money for food.
Yeah, right.
We've probably all done some variant of that.
Right.
But in general, like, I think if people really are that childlike, then we should be treating them like children. They're cognitively disabled and they clearly need the state to step in and be a ward. And if they're not that childlike, then we need to treat them as if they have exactly as much autonomy and exactly as much sort of ability to make good choices as the people who are making the laws.
And I think that's right. Camera recording time is swiftly coming to an end. We've got a couple more minutes left, but I think that I think is something we really need to agree on, and I'm very happy to agree that poor people around the world deserve the chance to be able to make their own choices and deserve their own autonomy. And I think that this again just sort of brings us back to how the struggles of poor people in the United States are linked to those elsewhere in the world who are trying also to get that kind of autonomy. And I think that, you know, whatever policies we use to get there, that's definitely the goal. I'm not at all for the welfare, you know, for a nanny state, one that commands and controls. And I think that definitely moving towards that kind of world is something that farmers in developing countries want just as much as working people in the United States.
Well, I think if I can sum up, I think the areas where we agree is that the World Bank is dysfunctional and that we should be, to the extent that we're distributing aid, we should be focusing much more on, you know, ways to sort of build institutions in developing countries and, like, giving people the tools to build it. First of all, humanitarian, just keeping people from starving, but second of all, giving people the societies the ability to build their own institutions from the ground up. Rather than sort of going in and thinking that we can just do shock treatment and you know, sort of force people into what I actually still think, I would argue, is the best model, the liberal market democracy, but I don't think that you can just sort of go in, give people money, and say, well, now you're going to be a liberal market democracy. I think it's turning out to be vastly more complicated than that. And on the other side, I think that we can also agree that that our carbon consumption and our meat consumption is unsustainable and that we need to, you know, certainly on the carbon side, that we need a tax to take care of that problem. Mm-hmm. But I think we're probably going to have to agree to disagree on the subject of taxes on unhealthy food.
I think we will.
But it's been great talking to you, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Megan. It's been great.
Take care.
You too.